Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Malaysia Airlines Flight 370 took off just after midnight on Saturday from Kuala Lumpur, headed for Beijing. 239 passengers and crew, a Boeing 777, a very experienced pilot. It headed out over the South China Sea, reached cruising altitude, and vanished. 6 days later, it's still missing. This hour on Point, where is Malaysia Airlines Flight 370? You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. How is it possible in this day and age that a big airliner and everyone aboard has just vanished? Are you following the latest? What is your theory of the case? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We're going to hear from some very experienced observers of airline flight and piloting and all the rest today. Joining us first today from Washington is Tom Costello, reporter for NBC News, where he covers aviation, one of the best. Tom Costello, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Nice to be here. Thank you.
This seems to be devolving into finger-pointing and emotion. What is the latest? Have any of these revelations about turning back over the Malacca Straits, flying over Malaysia, flying on for hours after it vanished, have they turned out debris in the South China Sea? Have these turned out to be confirmed?
No, at the moment we are pretty much exactly where we were a Friday night, early Saturday morning when this plane first disappeared. The latest as of this moment is that the Chinese are now saying that those satellite images that they released yesterday, which they said might show some wreckage in the South China Sea, the Malaysians say that they dispatched today aircraft to that area and found nothing, and the Chinese are suggesting that maybe perhaps they released that those images prematurely. You know, the Wall Street Journal reporting that this plane may have continued to fly for up to 4, perhaps 5 hours after its last known location over the South China Sea, and that there was this data transmitted. Planes transmit data regularly back to their mission bases, back to their maintenance bases. This is called ACARS data. And essentially, it's a running, kind of a running narrative of how the plane is performing, how the engines are performing, et cetera.
Yes.
And that some of that data suggested that the plane was still running up to 4 or 5 hours later. But today, the Malaysians came out and said that that's inaccurate, that the story's inaccurate, that the last ACARS data transmission came in at 1:07 a.m., and the plane essentially went off radar at about 1:20 or so a.m. I must tell you, the reporter for the Wall Street Journal who did that reporting is also one of the best, in my opinion. So, you know, we're in a situation here where the Malaysians themselves say one thing one day, the next day they walk it back, then the next day they qualify it again. There's been such inconsistent information coming out of Malaysia that it is really difficult to get your arms around this, but listen, the experts we talk to say all possibilities are still open. This plane may have gone down somewhere around Vietnam, or it may have flown out into the Indian Ocean, never to be seen again.
So the engine data may or may not have continued to broadcast. Malaysians say no. Good reporter says yes. What about the Malaysian military coming out? This was after some days and
yes.
Saying, you know what, we do have radar evidence that it may have taken this kind of fishhook back over the Malaysian peninsula and out into the Bay of Bengal, Indian Ocean. Are they sticking with that story?
Well, keep in mind, when I talked about inconsistencies, that's one of those areas. The Malaysian military initially said that to a local reporter. Then when that received wide publication, they kind of walked it back and said, well, wait a minute, we're not saying that this was definitively that plane. We're just saying that we had an unidentified plane at about that time along this trajectory. They have now given those military radar tapes, along with the civilian radar tapes, to the NTSB and the FAA for a more thorough analysis. And we are told now that they have given them the raw data as opposed to just the cleaned up version of it. And so the NTSB and FAA will presumably try to get a better handle on this as well. But, you know, if that theory holds, if the plane did do a U-turn and came back over the mainland and then back out over the Strait of Malacca, then it could be anywhere. I do think it's important to note that the Malaysians obviously put enough credence in that report that they activated that search zone on the western side of Malaysia.
Yes.
And they called in the Indian Navy to help. You wouldn't do that if you didn't think that there was significant evidence to suggest the plane headed that way.
And they were saying still today that even if there's some confusion, they're going to stick with it. Stand by, Tom. I've got here a little sound from the Malaysian Defense and Transportation Minister Hishamuddin Hussein saying it's not clear what the radar data show, but the authorities are investigating anyway.
On the radar signals, it is suggested that there was a possibility that an aircraft had passed over the Straits of Malacca. We have a duty to investigate any possibility. We owe it to the families of those on the flight to follow up every lead, and on that basis, we dispatch extra ships and aircraft to search the area.
The latest out of Malaysia today, Tom Costello with NBC News in Washington. At this point, how big is the search area or areas, Tom?
Well, the defined search area is about 31,000 square miles. But if you take into the possibility that this plane may have flown another 4 or 5 hours, then you're looking at a potential distance of 2,500 miles, and then you've got to do get some mathematician from MIT to figure out, okay, you know, in every single direction from the point of South Vietnam all the way in every possible direction, you know, it seems to me the possibilities are endless there. But we, you know, listen, it's, as we said, if they indeed did fly out over the Indian Ocean, this is one of the least traversed areas on the planet. You know, there's not a lot of maritime activity. There are not a lot of islands out there. You do have Diego Garcia military base way out in the Indian Ocean.
Yeah.
But presumably this plane could have gone down in the ocean. And if that happened, depending on the circumstances, did somebody try to land it on the ocean? And if so, did it stay intact and then sink? Or was there a crash and did it just come apart? You know, you could see whether you could – what I'm trying to get at is here, everybody has their own hypothesis of whether we will ever see debris from this plane.
Do we know, Tom, if lay people have the sense that the whole planet's being observed by satellites and you name it all the time. Is everybody showing their hand here? Is the United, the NSA, the Chinese, is everybody surrendering their intelligence on what's out there? Do we know?
You know, we don't know, right? We don't know what we don't know. There is every reason to believe, however, that we've been talking to our sources within U.S. intelligence, U.S. law enforcement. There is no sense within U.S. intelligence and U.S. law enforcement right now that this plane perhaps landed in some distant location. There is no sense here.
Okay.
That there was a – they still say no sense of terrorism. Now, that does not discount the possibility that a pilot went rogue, that somebody in that flight deck made a decision that they had a different agenda, or that somebody on board the plane that had undergone some sort of pilot training managed to hijack the plane. But, you know, I guess what I come back to is if you're going to hijack the plane and crash it into the water, if that's a possibility,
yeah,
then why take the trouble of doing a U-turn and flying 4 to 5 hours out into the Indian Ocean? Why not do it right there in the Gulf of Thailand? They have found no evidence of any debris in that area, which is very heavily trafficked between Malaysia and Vietnam.
Sure, sure. I get it when you say no sense that it landed somewhere. Though, I wanted to ask, could that have even been possible? We know planes are automated to a tremendous degree. Is it any way it could have just been brought down somewhere, or even come down automatically, even if the pilot was out, Tom?
That's highly, highly unlikely.
Okay.
To program in some other – first of all, if you're going to program another destination into the flight management system, then you're going to be needing to run off of your transmitters, your transponders, your GPS equipment, et cetera. You can't do that quietly and silently.
But then when you say no sense of terrorism,
right,
what do you mean by that? Why not? I mean, how do we know if we don't know?
At the moment, based on the information they have, U.S. intelligence satellites never picked up any explosion in the air, never any flash of any sort.
Okay.
And they don't have any evidence yet that anybody on board was a known terrorist. You recall those two individuals traveling on stolen passports. This is a part of the world where, unfortunately, that's quite common. And these two individuals we know were Iranian teenagers, and one of them trying to get to Germany, allegedly to immigrate there where his mother lived.
But that leaves 230-plus other people. I mean, how do we know that none of them could have had a terrorism motive?
We don't know, but we're going on, the Malaysian investigation into this, and the Malaysians, as you might expect, are claim that they're doing a thorough job. We did today, I should tell you, this is some original reporting today, NBC News.
Yes.
Went to the co-pilot's home and talked to friends, went to the mosque where he prayed, and they all felt that this is a pretty normal guy, everyday guy who, they have nothing to say that would suggest he had ulterior motives.
Listen, we'd like to know. I'm sure you get heavy breathing from your bosses. They'd like to. Everybody wants to know. Do you have the sense, Tom Costello, that we are going to know ultimately what happened with this plane? Or could it just end up being a perpetual mystery?
I think it could end up being a perpetual mystery. Now, listen, I could be contradicted in 5 minutes.
Sure, we understand.
And any correspondent on this story is reluctant to hypothesize because you could be proven wrong in a minute.
Yeah.
But we are now 6 days into this, and the search area is vast. And if you take all the hypotheses out there about the potential distance this plane went, it's entirely possible this plane went down somewhere, and perhaps someday something will wash ashore, and we'll know definitively that the plane went down. But finding the black boxes, which is really the only way that you're going to figure out what happened to this plane, is going to be increasingly difficult.
Tom Costello with NBC News. Incredible. It's like an episode of Lost, except that it's all too real. Yeah. And these are 239 souls, as they say, at this point, lost. And all the anguish that goes with that, and the anguish of not knowing. Tom Costello with NBC News, thank you very much for joining us. Great to have you.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the missing Malaysia Air Flight 370, the so far simply vanished aircraft. We're asking, where is that plane? Of course, the families of the 239 people on board above all want to know. Chinese families we've seen all over television, many at a hotel near the Beijing International Airport, some speaking with CNN earlier today about their frustrations as they waited for word of what has happened on board that flight. Here interpreted by CNN.
I'm not going home until I know what happened. We've lost loved ones, and they need to answer our questions. When are you going to tell us? And what are you going to do? We still don't know if they are alive or dead.
And here's Irene Burrows, mother of Rod Burrows, Australian passenger now missing on Wednesday, as today. She just didn't know what was going on.
There is no news whatsoever. It's just disappeared off the face of the earth. And if we could just find some wreckage or something, would be a help, probably. But not this.
6 days and counting. Malaysia Airlines, so Malaysia at the heart of this, their defense and transportation minister, saying earlier today in Kuala Lumpur, we know there's complaints, but we're not going to give up.
Some claim that Malaysia has slowed down the search. That is totally not true. In fact, we have intensified the search. Again, let me be clear, there is no real precedent for a situation like this. The plane vanished. We have extended the search area because it is our duty to follow every lead, and we owe it to the families. And trust me when I say we will not give up.
We'll not give up, but it's 6 days and counting now. Joining me now from Austin, Texas, is Colonel J.F. Joseph, retired U.S. Marine Corps colonel, 30 years experience in accident analysis and reconstruction. He flew with the Navy's Blue Angels as a pilot and safety officer, now at Joseph Aviation Consulting. A very experienced eye on this world, Colonel Joseph. Thanks for joining us. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thank you.
And with me in the studio, Patrick Smith, an active airline pilot for a large commercial carrier, been flying cargo and passenger jets on domestic and international routes since 1990. He blogs at Ask the Pilot, was on Time Magazine's list of top 25 bloggers of 2013, author of Cockpit Confidential, everything you need to know about air travel, questions, answers, and reflections. Patrick Smith, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Colonel J.F. Joseph, what about the quality of the search and inquiry so far? Are the right things being done?
Well, I certainly think they are. I will tell you, I think that, you know, those of us who have been in the investigation business for a long time recognize that information wants to be disseminated as quickly as possible, but the analysis finally has to be made on the facts. And I think the NTSB and Boeing and the FAA, once they're able to get a hold of really analyze the raw radar data and smooth it and do some good trend analysis on it, we'll be able to come up with some good factual picture of what we may know of the last known point that the aircraft actually existed in terms of radar and viability of the aircraft. So I think if we sit back, take a deep breath with this from a empirical standpoint, without really jumping to a lot of conclusions on the same, because the theories out there are running rapid, and it could be any number of things. But again, just to kind of hone back in on the facts and take a deep breath give the system a chance to work. And I think Boeing and the NTSB are going to come up with some good data for us, and I would think relatively near term.
But you say raw radar data, and I think a lot of people assume that it would always be, its path would be tracked all the time. But we've read since the plane went down that, in fact, once passenger liners get out over the ocean, they often pass out of any radar coverage range.
Well, I think in the traditional sense, that may be true. I would say that I think from the intelligence communities, both from the United States and around the world, a lot of these entities simply don't want to tip their hand at this point. They want to contribute to the extent that they can, particularly if they felt that there was the possibility of survivors and being able to get to those people on board the aircraft had it been a successful ditching or diversion. But it really is one of those things where I think that the people that are talking or that really don't know that much about the intel side of the surveillance aspect of this, and the ones that do simply aren't saying anything at all.
Patrick Smith, with me here in the studio, pilot yourself, Ask the Pilot blogger, do you presume that there is somewhere a digital record of this plane's full flight, including its end, or not?
Well, that's possible, but not necessarily the case. And, you know, this is fascinating. I think, Tom, this story really has become transcendent in a way. It's no longer a story about a presumed aviation disaster. It's a mystery story. You know, where is the airplane? And that's really what's captivating people. And in a way, that's too bad, because what we need to be talking about eventually is what happened on board the aircraft. We might never know. And meanwhile,
well, I mean, it is a mystery. There's no question about that. But I think the reason people care is that that's a lot of lives, and people do want to know what
absolutely
happened here.
And the real question that we need to have answered now as quickly as we can is, did the airplane in fact wander around off course for hundreds or even thousands of miles after something happened? Until we know that, we really can't speculate too broadly.
What's a scenario in which it would or could even wander around for thousands of miles?
Yeah, I'm uncomfortable even going down that avenue because
well, let me ask
whatever
specific questions.
Let's
say there was some event. I don't know what – is there some event that would leave everybody unconscious but the plane would go on its own?
Conceivably,
like
yes.
What?
For example, and again, this is just me speculating.
No, I'm not saying this is what happened, but we're trying to.
An explosive or a sudden decompression of some kind that the crew did not respond to appropriately could render the crew and perhaps everybody on the aircraft incapacitated. That's very unlikely. And depressurizations, I don't want to use the word routine, but they are something that air crews are trained to handle, and in and of themselves, they're not non-survivable by any stretch.
Not non-survivable, you're saying?
Correct.
Right. Colonel J.F. Joseph, can you picture a scenario in which people, everybody perhaps even, or at least the pilots, would be knocked out of commission, but the plane would go on for a long time?
Well, Tom, I will tell you, I mean, that the hypoxic theory is, you know, where loss of pressurization is certainly viable. The Payne Stewart mishap that we had in the United States several years ago was a case of that, where pressurization had been lost. I recently worked in an accident where, in fact, carbon monoxide had incapacitated the flight crew within the last couple of years. So these things do happen. Now, a large transport category airplane, such as the 777, I taught at the airlines, the Airbus, for a number of years. And I will tell you, as mentioned earlier, I mean, the syllabuses that pilots go through in these the airlines and large cargo carriers and large transport category aircraft, virtually every simulator session, either in through indoctrination or the initial phase of training, mm-hmm. or through the recurrent checks, one of the things that is almost done on every single check, right, is what we call a high dive or loss of pressurization, where the crew reacts to that. Part of the certification process for all these aircraft is that they're able to get down below 10,000 feet within a certain period of time.
Where they would have oxygen enough to work without, to get back conscious and at work, I guess.
Well, the drill is to don the oxygen mask and establish communication and get the aircraft down below 10,000 feet as quickly and safely as you can. So having said that, it is, I would not call it a routine maneuver, but it's certainly one that's rehearsed and practiced and one that's planned for. You know, that is one scenario. Now, the loss of redundant electrical systems or systems that would preclude the transponder from, you know, emitting a signal and ACARs with downlinks and things like that to the ground, either airport or airline operations or to maintenance, things like that, you know, it is somewhat convoluted and they kind of contradict each other. In the sense that, you know, you have an incapacitated crew, but the aircraft would continue to fly and no longer emit signals. So a lot of speculation with that. It could be any number of things, and they are somewhat inconsistent with each other.
Colonel Joseph, stand by. Patrick Smith, we've got so many questions from our listeners. I want to begin to bring them in. Rick in Aiken, South Carolina. Rick, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Thanks, Tom, for taking my call.
Yeah.
One comment. We heard... it might have been just a rumor that the family from the passengers were calling their cell phones, were calling the passenger's cell phone, and rather than it just go dead, as would be presumed if it were at the bottom of the ocean, it would ring first and then go to a voicemail. Kind of strange. The other, if you don't mind, a second comment, mm-hmm. I'd like to hear your guests respond to the fact that it was at 35,000 cruising altitude. That's an odd number, meaning it went in a particular direction. Even that's the 1,000-foot space between them. I'm a pilot, so that's all I have. Thank you.
Got it, Rick. Patrick, the altitude, does it suggest something to you in particular?
No, not necessarily. I mean, what he said is basically true, but that's not always the case. The flight levels you fly at for certain directions, that's not always the way it works, depending where in the world you are.
So it wouldn't indicate where it was headed or what it was up to at the time.
It's a clue, but here's something, Tom. I think people need to understand, because the question everybody's asking is, how can a plane disappear from view? I mean, airplanes are tracked, and over the course of a flight, a crew is always in contact one way or the other with air traffic control and also with company staff on the ground. Now, how that communication takes place depends where you are, which air traffic control facility you're working with. It could be over VHF radio, HF radio, ACARS, SATCOM, FMS, data link, and so on. And meanwhile, there are large areas of the world, in fact, most of the world, that are not covered by traditional air traffic control radar. And so, okay, how does all of that stuff stop
or
working?
I would think cell phone coverage to our listeners' question. I don't know about ringing cell phones.
So with all of that equipment and all of those capabilities, why did the plane vanish? And there are two possibilities there. The first is foul play. Some sort of in-flight takeover, a hijacking. And remember, not all hijackings, when you go back over the long history of air piracy, are 9/11-style takeovers by Islamic fundamentalists looking to crash a plane into a building. It could have been something totally different. And the other possibility is some sort of catastrophic mechanical failure, a decompression that wasn't dealt with properly, a complete electrical failure for some bizarre reason could render all of that stuff inoperative. For all of the technological advantages we have now and the all the immediacy that's out there, you know, the stuff only works if it's powered. I mean, you can't be on social media if somebody just pulls the plug out of your computer.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, that's the analogy here.
But we don't think of airliners as just going down just like that. Mark in Glastonbury, Connecticut. Mark, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Listen, you've got experts there, and my question is, why are these all these planes, you know, all the airliners all around the world tracked by radar rather than GPS? They, you know, with a GPS, they would know exactly where it is. I mean, you can buy a Honda Civic or a cell phone, you know, and that knows where you are all the time.
They are tracked by GPS, but if your GPS stops working, what do you do? I mean, you know, the technology here, advanced as it is, can only go so far.
Colonel Joseph, why would any signal from this plane stop? Patrick says foul play or mechanical failure. How do you interpret it?
Well, those are the two possibilities. I mean, I worked the Air France 447 accident as an expert, and
the one over the South Atlantic where it went down deep.
That's correct. And, you know, one of the benefits that we had to that particular mishap is that the information was being downlinked, not just to maintenance and to the company, but the faults that were being indicated to the flight crew were cascading, and that information was downloaded as well. In that particular case, the FMS was downloading position reports virtually continuously, and some aircraft have that capacity and some aircraft don't. And obviously, in the case of where you're working in a non-radar environment in the middle of the ocean, so to speak, the transmission of that data, position reporting, as was indicated earlier, is either done over the HF radios or VHF radios, depending on where the position of the aircraft is. And it is predicated on the known position, either established through GPS or, you know, through some other sort of navigation, and then transmitting the data verbally by the pilots. In this case, you know, with loss of electrical power, the GPS is no longer producing the capacity to report that. A position, you know, is essentially lost, and with nobody doing a verbal assertion of the aircraft's position, then that's lost as well. Not to delve too deeply into the sinister side of the possibilities here, but as time progresses more and more, it does look more and more likely that that may be the case for this mishap.
Why?
Well, I think all the valid data that we would have traditionally had, that we would have known, in terms of crews reporting malfunctions or some sort of anomaly aboard the aircraft, or the systems themselves downlinking, we have an absolute absence of that. This may inevitably be the case where we're not going to know until the black boxes, the cockpit voice recorder and flight data recorder, are in fact recovered. You know, we've got, probably a good month of that, with the new, flight data recorders where that pinging data will be available, where we'll be able to retrieve it. But again, deep water recovery. Now, this is not nearly as deep to water as we had, with the Air France 447 mishap. That was in about 3,000 meters of water. But to be able to recover that data, the acoustic equipment that needs to be in there to be able to drive the signal and then hone in on the wreckage and the debris field, it takes some time. It really does, and we're working against that time element right now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about missing Malaysia Air Flight 370, the so far simply vanished aircraft, asking, where's the plane? The whole world asking that question at this point. 239 passengers and crew just gone, 6 days and counting now. Patrick Smith is with us. He blogs at Ask the Pilot, active airline pilot for a large commercial carrier, author of Cockpit Confidential. Colonel J.F. Joseph joins us from Austin, Texas, retired U.S. Marine Corps colonel, flew with the Blue Angels, has done years and years of aviation accident investigation, and joins us from Austin, Texas today. The day after, talking with reporters in Beijing, Malaysia Airlines commercial director Hugh Dunleavy said the missing plane had recently had a full safety check.
This particular aircraft was in the hangar. Now it's probably 11 days ago, and it went through its A-check. Nothing was untoward was found with the aircraft, and of course it's been operating 14 or 15 hours a day since that time without any issues.
Still gone. At a news conference in Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur on Tuesday, Malaysian Police Chief Khalid Abu Bakar said police were focusing on four possible scenarios in the investigation of the jet's disappearance.
Hijacking, sabotage, personal problem amongst the crews and the passengers, and also psychological problem among the crews and passengers.
Hijacking, sabotage, personal problem between the crew or passengers, psychological problems with the crew or passenger. Here we are. We still don't know. John in Buffalo. John, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm wondering whether it's possible to reprogram the flight control computer either on the ground or hack it via data link.
So somebody is sort of taking over remote, Colonel Joseph?
I'll tell you, I've operated a number of flight management systems. I think certainly anything is possible. I think it's highly unlikely at this point. However, to manipulate the FMS in flight to change the destination or reroute the aircraft is certainly that's what it's made for. But I would tend to think that's highly unlikely that it could be hacked into or somebody take I guess what you would call remote control of the aircraft.
Harold in Morton, Illinois. I know Morton. Harold, thanks for joining us. You're on.
Hey, thank you for taking my call. I'm over here at street. Putting our string theories out here, and is it possible that these airplanes could have gone flying off into deeper water?
And therefore be harder to find. Patrick Smith, clearly, if it did cross the Malaysian Peninsula, get out over the Indian Ocean, then it's not that shallow South China Sea anymore. It would be deeper there.
It could be very deep, unrecoverably deep, perhaps. By the way, the last caller's point about remote hijacking, I find that to be virtually inconceivable. And that gets to something I talk about in my book and that is coming up periodically in this conversation, which is the cockpit automation is something that's grossly misunderstood and exaggerated in the media. And people have this idea that these airplanes fly themselves and the crew simply puts in a few inputs and off you go and the airplane takes itself
it's
to the destination.
It's certainly our impression that once they're up at cruising altitude, there's a lot of automation at play.
There is a lot of automation, but the automation only does what the crew tells it to do. You have to mm-hmm. tell it what to do, when to do it, and how to do it. There are different modes, different levels of automation.
Okay.
That's one of the reasons I don't like the term autopilot. I prefer the term autoflight system because mm-hmm. it's actually a collection of components that have different tasks. Meanwhile, I think overarching all of this, we need to, as I said earlier, we need to find out for sure before we go further whether or not the plane flew off somewhere past the point when contact was lost.
Mm-hmm.
Until that's known. And meanwhile, we're getting these mixed messages from people on the scene, wherever the scene is exactly. You've got these different investigative entities coming to us from halfway around the world in
yep.
our case.
Yep.
You've got language issues, and their messages get put into the media and filtered through there. And so what we're finally hearing on our end may or may not be what investigators are actually saying. Then on top of that, you've got the vernacular of commercial aviation, which is very confusing to people, these terms transponder, radar, radio. I mean, they mean different things depending on the circumstances. And meanwhile, our demand for fast and easy answers just kind of makes this cycle worse. I think we need to just step back and let the people who were there do their thing and hopefully find the aircraft.
I mean, that sounds great, but 6 days, you'd expect something more.
Six days is an unusually, exceptionally long time to go without finding any wreckage. However, you go back and look over the history of aviation accidents, and the fact is that there are many that remain shrouded in mystery and essentially unsolved. You know, rares as they are, things like this happen sometimes. There's a 747, a South African Airways 747, somewhere at the bottom of the Indian Ocean. that disappeared about 20 years ago. They've never recovered it.
Could have company now. Nate in Willow Spring, North Carolina. Nate, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I have about 12 years in intelligence experience with the Army, and you know, an aircraft traveling at this height and at this speed, granted, if a catastrophic event happened, I mean, you know, the debris field would be wide, but it's still possible, and you would certainly think that something would have surfaced. Now, I know from dealing with certain groups, global groups in the past, that you have a lot of very savvy people out there who definitely know, and I'm speaking of, you know, someone who would be more in the line of a terrorist, who definitely have knowledge of the electronics and the operation of aircraft. And I don't think it's impossible that one of them could have somehow or another disabled the communication devices. And we may yet find this plane has been landed somewhere. For what reason, we don't know. We can only speculate. But I do not think it's out of the realm of possibility.
It's not out of the realm of possibility, but it's also extremely unlikely.
Why?
I think there are much more likely scenarios than that. I think the fact that we haven't found anything is inspiring people to come up with these more and more outlandish, if still borderline conceivable ideas, that the airplane was flown to North Korea or landed somewhere in Sudan. I mean, What can you do with that?
Colonel Joseph, can you really shut down all the signaling devices in flight? Could somebody who knew the electronics do that, make it go dark in effect?
Well, I will tell you, a number of years ago, I worked at the ValuJet 592 accident back in 1994. When wiring harnesses become burnt through to where the systems are disabled, catastrophic failure of an electrical system certainly can occur, but in this case, with the typical redundancies, particularly in a large complex airplane such as a 777, I would consider, other than just a sinister act in itself, something catastrophic to make something like this happen. I would like to just dovetail, if I could, for a moment on in terms of search and rescue. I've done a number of search and rescue missions at Blue Water Operations, Deep Sea, and well out over the ocean. And I will tell you, if you're given a specific grid square with a precise latitude and longitude to search for wreckage, it's extremely difficult. There are many factors that come into play, sea state visibility, sun angles, time of day, a number of things that complicate and oftentimes convolute the possibility that you're going to see anything, even if you are on top of the wreckage. So
you can fly right over it.
Absolutely. And many times crews that are out there for hours and hours on end looking through a set of binoculars out a window, it's extremely fatiguing. And best case scenario, it's very, very difficult. So again, if we look at this thing from the last known position of the aircraft, and from that point on, essentially, the aircraft could have traveled 4 or 5 hours at 500 miles an hour in 360 different directions. The possibility where that aircraft and the wreckage could be is anywhere.
How close do you have to get to, let's say there's wreckage, and we hope not, but at this point, how close do you have to be to it to pick up the pinging, Colonel Joseph?
Well, that would depend on the acoustic equipment on board, either the aircraft, magnetic anomaly detectors, that are on board aircraft, such as a P-3 Orion that the Navy uses and some of the foreign air forces use as well. But in deep water recovery, the capacity of a ship to acquire acoustic information from the pinging, it's very esoteric. It's designed specifically for that, and the equipment is certainly out there. And when we recovered the 447 mishap and the data from that, it was precisely that type of equipment that it took.
How far away could they be, though? Are we talking a mile, 100 miles? I mean, how far does that ping travel, or with the most sensitive equipment?
Well, it depends, again, on the depth of the water, the terrain of the water, where the signal can be blocked by, the ocean floor.
Underwater mountain or whatever, yeah.
That's exactly right.
Oh, boy, so you just don't know. Bruce in Berlin, Connecticut. Bruce, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This incident is reminding me a little of the famous British de Havilland Comet of 1949, the first commercial jetliner to be flown. And after three of them went down without explanation, finally the explanation was that it was It was fuselage and metal fatigue that caused the plane to break up into several pieces in mid-flight. It took them a long time to discover this and to put the story back together again, and they never recovered from the loss.
I appreciate your call, Bruce. But, Patrick, in this case, Boeing 777, I mean, catastrophic failure like that, metal fatigue, does that seem possible here?
It's possible.
After all the testing?
It's always possible.
And the thing was just tested a few days before this flight?
True. Unlikely, but it remains possible, as do various other scenarios. And further to the colonel's point about wreckage recovery, the dynamics of air crashes can be very different. Here we would need to know if the airplane impacted the water, how that would affect how the plane broke up or didn't break up and what size pieces would be out there and where they would be and so on. So there's no easy answer there either.
Brandon, Mobile, Alabama. Brandon, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. How's it going?
Okay.
My comment is, if I haven't heard it in the media with all the disputes in the South China Sea, if maybe the Chinese military could have mistakenly shot this plane down.
I mean, there's also a lot of commercial civilian air traffic in the South China Sea, but it's true, Colonel Jeff Joseph, this is a hotly disputed region of the world lately. I don't know. I mean, we're looking for explanations here. One, you would think that the coverage of the Chinese satellite coverage of this would be very intense, given their territorial disputes with Vietnam and the Philippines and everything else here. What about the possibility of some mishap that governments don't want to talk about?
Well, it certainly happened in the past, reminiscent of KAL-007 back in, I believe, 1984, where the Soviets shot down a 747. It has happened. It's happened in the Mediterranean. These things do happen. I will say this. I think in an instance like that, with the notoriety, particularly with the intelligence that capacity that we have and the rest of the world really has, something like that would be very, very hard to conceal to this point. In fact, it would be, in many cases, almost immediately disseminated for obvious reasons. But the something as overt as that is not without beyond the realm of possibility. Like I said, it has happened. It will probably happen again. But there's certainly nothing at this point to indicate that, but it's something that can't be ruled out.
Loose ends here. A caller earlier asked about cell phone calls to passengers on the plane and phones ringing or a report thereof. Does that make any sense to you?
I really don't know. I think that's I think some analysis has been done on that, and I don't think it's going to give much flesh to this thing. I think it's been somewhat disputed. But again, in this day and age with the technology, there's no telling. I think it's more intriguing that the trend analysis data, if that bears some fruit that was sent down to Rolls-Royce, if that has any merit, I'm more inclined to believe that than I am anything.
And what would that be looking at, that trend analysis data?
Well, most airlines, most fleets are monitored to determine the efficiency of engines. Long-term analysis with engine data, temperatures, pressures, and things like that being downlinked every 30 minutes or so, you can tell through a trend that you may have a failing component or one that's due for change or loss of efficiency. And it's very effective in terms of maintenance and safety programs. So that's why that information is downlinked. And again, most big, large carriers do that because fuel efficiency is everything, and then maintenance in ahead of a mishap, or certainly that's something that the airlines want to stay ahead of.
If this flight has gone down in such a way that its debris is least likely to show up, if that's what's happened, does that in itself suggest a more likely mechanical or terrorism scenario, Colonel Joseph?
It's very difficult to say, and it's absolute speculation at this point. Certainly, if it was something catastrophic, then we look at the possibility of the mechanical failure where, a structure failed at high flight dynamics, high air speeds, high altitudes. high differential pressures on the cabin, one scenario. And then again, we get into the sinister side of the thing if it were a terrorist act of some sort. It is kind of interesting when you look at this thing that the loss of radar contact with this aircraft occurred shortly after level off. You know, with the aircraft at 35,000 feet, which it looks like that was a filed altitude for this particular routing to destination. If an aircraft were to arrive at 35,000 feet with a cabin differential, cabin pressure of, say, 8,000 feet internal to the cabin, there are devices out there that if somebody was able to get on board the aircraft that are barometric sensitive, such that detonation would occur when the device reached a certain barometric altitude and pressure. That's certainly not saying that that's what happened, but that is a possibility. And we know that when we look back on the Pan Am detonation over Lockerbie, it was something very similar to that.
But, my goodness, to take it up and blow it up without any sense of what or why, I'm not sure what statement it makes for a terrorist, if indeed that is at all what happened here, and at this point, we still don't know. Colonel J.F. Joseph with us today from Austin, Texas, at Joseph Aviation Consulting. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Tom.
Patrick Smith with Ask the Pilot with me in the studio. Patrick, thank you for coming in, author of Cockpit Confidential. Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.